Hello, FanaCheck listeners. S3E12 is a special one. I've got a special guest today. He's a man with many names, many disguises. Some of you know him as Charlie Butts from Escape from Alcatraz. Some of you know him as Doobie, the cab driver in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Others of you might think of him as the donut-eating cop in Home Alone. I like to think of him as Tom Pepper, the fake Kramer in Seinfeld. But I've got friends who are like, no, that's Carl from Billy Madison. Yet others, not friends of mine, know him as Mr. Heckles from Friends. And then the really cool people think of him as Old Joe, the junkyard owner on Breaking Bad. He is Oscar winner, improviser, writer, stand-up comedian, actor, thought provoker, and now writer. Larry Hankin. The book is That Guy, a cautionary memoir. Larry Hankin is one of the most prolific character actors of all time. 196 credits on IMDb with more to come. He's 85 years old, going strong, and he spent about an hour with your boy Fanacek. So, enjoy. All right, I am joined today by writer, improviser, comedian, actor, director, Oscar nominee, Larry Hankin. Larry, welcome to Fanacek, man. Thank you for doing this.
Well, thank you for having me.
I could not be more amazed. So what I do typically on Fanacek, just so you know, is I'm obsessed with the work, the credits. I go down IMDb and I talk about what actors work together and directors, and I'll go down that rabbit hole. So when I had the opportunity to work with you on this podcast, I thought, well, this is going to be a layup. This guy's been in everything, 200 plus credits. I have so many things to talk about until I read your book. So the book, of course, That Guy, a cautionary memoir, which we'll talk about. I bought it on Amazon. I gave it the 5-star review.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah. But I realized that that's not what I'm going to do with you, because your IMDb credits are not your life's work, are they, Larry?
No, they're not.
What do you consider to be your life's work?
Well, I was just thinking about this last night. I consider myself, I had a definition last night. Well, I consider myself a stand-up anthropologist, really. That's kind of my life's work. I just figured that out. Now, I didn't know that all along, but it's been true all along, that I really like the anthropological history of Homo sapiens. And then I look at it like today, us today. And I go, wow, man, we don't know our ass from our elbow.
and it took you 85 years to figure that out, huh?
Pretty much, yeah. Wow. Well, maybe I figured it out maybe 80 years or, 75 years. I've been knowing that for like a while. I'm writing another book where I wrote that down.
Okay. So is that what I have to look forward to, Larry, is to realize, oh, we don't know our asses from our elbows.
Well, I guess so. I mean, it's really difficult writing a second book. The first book, it's like stand-up comedians. This is where I learned this in stand-up. They said, when I first started, they said, I was trying to get an album. A comedy album.
Sure.
This is way back in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. It was very difficult. And so I couldn't get a, and I thought, well, I don't know. It's just that I don't know if I could do another second book, because the first album of a comedy is all your collection of everything you did up until you started to think about getting an album for comedy.
Sure.
So you have a couple of years of stuff before you start thinking about an album.
A lifetime full of material, basically.
Right. And then the second album is you start from scratch.
Right.
And then you go, whoa, holy cow. I mean, how do I do my second album? I don't have anything at all. Sure. I used it all up in my first album, all the best stuff. So that's kind of the second book.
It's also, I feel like, it's,
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, it's daunting.
I also feel like, too, it's almost like an ignorance is bliss. Like, you don't know how much work the first one's going to be. And so once you do, once you've done the thing, the idea of climbing up that mountain again, you're like, I don't know if I have that in me.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right.
Yeah, I've heard like Jerry Seinfeld talk about that. And so did, Tina Fey talking about how they don't think they could do big shows again. Because when he did Seinfeld, of course, when she did 30 Rock, they didn't know what they were getting into. So they created these big juggernaut shows. And now that they know the work and the time it takes, they're like, I couldn't do it again. Like, that's just too much. And had they known that, they may not have done it the first time.
Exactly. And luckily, I had been kind of writing a book all along, in that I was taking stories that I saw, that you saw in the book, that you read in the book, all those things that happened to me all along the way, I would be telling people about, you know, just talking, saying, you know, hey, how was the Friends show? This happened and that happened. And I would tell that story over and over again. I kind of solidified it, just telling about Friends.
Sure.
And then somebody said, well, why don't you write a book about it? You're going to forget it. I think it was me who said it to me. and I thought, yeah, I better. So I called a friend who was a disc jockey and a podcaster like you. And I said, hey, we did a podcast. And I said, I have a lot of stories. He kept on asking me about them. And I told him, I said, you know, I should be recording these. And he said, well, I am recording them. We're recording them. We're doing a podcast. And I said, no, I mean, like, I got about like 30 or 40 of these shows that I did that are great stories I've been telling. And he said, let's record them once a week. You know, we'll meet on Saturday on the phone, or, you know, on the tube, and he'll record them. He'll really record them. Right. You know, because he lives in New Jersey and I live in California. Mm-hmm. So I said, yeah, okay. So we did that for about 8 weeks, and we got about 8 hours of stuff, and that was the book. So I didn't have to write anything. He just recorded it. And then there's an app for that. Microsoft has an app that you can talk into it and it'll type it out.
Right.
So he had one of those. He just took his recordings and he pushed it in and it typed it out. And then I just rewrote that, or I edited that.
Sure.
So that was kind of easy, you know, just rewriting sentences for reading instead of hearing. So that's, I don't have that for the second book. Sure. I got to start from scratch, and it's really, I've tried, I'm trying. It's really hard to come up with that much material.
Sure. You know, well, and to speak to your point, some of those stories you've been telling for so long, you've shaped them. You know the beats, you know the rhythm, you know what works, what doesn't. I mean, you like you said, you already had it written. You just had to get it recorded, essentially.
Exactly. Yeah. And now, not only am I trying to, you know, come up with these things, these interesting stories from my life, because my show business history is in the book. So my life, and that's even harder, because, you know, stuff I did 20 years ago that I didn't think I would ever use because it wasn't show business.
Right.
You know, reality, like Girlfriends or where I lived or what I did when I was homeless. I was homeless for a year.
Sure.
And it was really interesting. I that would be great to write about. I'm kind of writing about that.
That could be a book in itself, just that year. Yeah.
Well, that you just said that. It's a year. Basically, what I did was I took my life in that year, and I just gave it to a character.
Okay.
You know, so I didn't. And sometimes I call him Larry. Sometimes I call him. Justice, not Emmett. Emmett is what I was. I have several names.
Sure.
It's
Emmett. Sometimes the other.
Well, so, sometimes Jones. No, sometimes Jones is the first. That's the Academy Award nomination that I got. I made a film short about Sometimes Jones.
Sally's Diner.
Sally's Diner, right.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And the thing about that is he was Sally's Diner and Sometimes Jones was the character I made up for my younger life. You know, I was like 30, mm-hmm. you know, in my 20s and 30s when I did that and made up. So anything kind of Sometimes Jones, I wrote a lot of stories about Sometimes Jones, but they're all for someone 18 to 25. You okay. know. So I can't write that or play that anymore. So, and I got into show business. The book starts when I graduated college. So right. I must've been about 18, 19, 20 around there. So anything before 18, 19 or 20, and then stuff in between, you know, like 30 or 40, that's kind of hard to remember if I never really wrote it down. See, the other things I was just telling the stories over and over again. And they were just like, you know, hammered into my subconscious, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, although I try to tell them now and I got to refer to the book.
Hey, maybe that's a great way to sell more books. Hey, I don't remember the story. Buy the book.
Well, that's what I do. I say, well, you know, you got to buy the book. You got to buy it. On the other hand, I can take it on the stage because that's how I was doing. Every once in a while, I would take one of the stories and take it on the stage. I was doing one-man shows
okay.
in my 40s and 50s and using some Sometimes Jones stuff and some stuff I was make up and some of the stories I was telling in the book. So I know I can do that again, you know, if I wanted to go back on stage and sell the book that way. You know,
absolutely.
Appearances.
If I may, I wanted to talk about your early career. You know, after college, you went to Greenwich Village, you start working the open mics and you're working around legends. Peter Palomary, yeah. Bob Dylan, Lenny Bruce, you're opening for Woody Allen. And something you said about the Village jumped out at me. You said that you gained access to the lifestyle, like you really fit there.
Yeah.
But I think that, and going with that, I feel like frustration was the theme in your career. And here's why I say that. Because also to quote from your book, the work became more and more unenjoyable as the venues and headliners got bigger. And I feel like that would kind of remain a theme for you. You never, you obviously progressed, you know, from Greenwich to obviously Second City and the Committee in San Francisco. And then with the LA coming up, you never seemed terribly happy. Would you agree that frustration was kind of a theme for you?
Well, frustration, I think there's a better word for it. It was frustration, but it was also disappointment and also an inability to figure out the game of Hollywood. I never really got the game. They weren't my people.
Was it an inability to figure out the game or just a lack of desire to play that game?
A lack of desire to play.
Yeah. You don't. I mean, yeah, you marched to beat your own drummer. I didn't get the vibe that you're full of shit at all. You didn't want to play that game.
No, but I couldn't figure out if I got out what I would do. You know, in other words, I'm a performer. I am. I'm a show business guy. I mean, that's how I've made my living all my life.
Absolutely.
Some sort of performing, acting, comedian, writer, something to do with, you know, performance. But I couldn't, I fell into the trap of Hollywood, and there's a big trap of Hollywood, and everybody is very sub rosa. Nobody talks about it. I don't even think half the people know that they're playing a game. They're just, and the game is that you try to, you know, get as famous as you can so you can get more money, and become a star. That's the game. The trap is that on that road, your salary starts to go up. You start from nothing. And it's very noticeable because it's in a very short time. And the game is that you make so much money, you start renting things higher and higher. And then you reach some sort of, if you don't become famous, you're paying too much for rent. That's what happened. So I was trapped. I had to keep working as an actor to pay my rent.
Sure.
I was working for my rent. That was all.
And wow. That's why it was no fun anymore. I couldn't say no to jobs. I couldn't take jobs. I couldn't go up for jobs that I wanted because there wasn't enough money in it. So money became just a trap. I had to keep making a lot of money to pay my rent, and I couldn't figure out how to get off that merry-go-round.
Interesting. I don't think that's limited to just the entertainment industry. It's almost like the American dream, right? You make more money so you can buy more, then you got to make more money to keep buying more or to keep what
exactly.
You got.
That's the Ponzi scheme of America.
Sure.
Of capitalism.
Yeah.
In other words, that's how they built the pyramids. Let's make them make something bigger than they can make. And yeah. Then, you just have to keep working and building and building and building, and nobody can stop working or everybody will revolt and I won't be Pharaoh anymore.
Wow. Yeah, well said, man. At least you were doing something cool along the way. It could have been worse. You could have been selling Chevys, you know?
Well, yeah. In other words, I liked what I was doing for a while. So in other words, while I was in it, I didn't like it, but there was nothing else that I liked any better.
Sure.
Really, kind of.
I want to take it back a little bit earlier. You talk a lot about your parents. I detected some anger towards both your parents, but towards your dad in particular. Your dad even cut you out of his will. How did that, or did that even inform you as a performer? Did that give you an edge? Did you have an anger towards?
I try to figure that out. The only thing I can come up with is I had a kind of a vapid upbringing. Nothing. There was no input in my life as a kid, except going outside on the street and play, and then I would get into mischief. I mean, I had a lot of energy. I'd burn down a barn. I would plant a lot in the middle of the road. How you do that, by the way, those army shovels? It was kind of clever, but the army shovels, the shovel part folds down.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Like that.
Yeah.
Well, you can also fold it like that, so you can use it as a rake, mm-hmm. or a scraper. Well, I'd use it that way as a rake. And what I would do is I turned upside down, so I had the handle, and I take the shovel part, and I would scoop it under the roots of plants in a nearby lot. And I would just carry it to the middle of the street and set it there. And I would just keep on doing that. And I would just plant the lot right across the road.
And you grew up where, in Long Island?
Yeah, Far Rockaway, Long Island. Oh. Now the police would come. I mean, people call the cop. They didn't know who did it.
Right.
Now, luckily, I have no idea why, because it was the middle of the street I was doing it. But cars would stop. How do you get through this? What is it? And then, and then finally somebody just ran right over it. And then there was this mess in the middle of the road.
Sure.
And then the police knocked on my door. My family door. And they said, could you please come out? They said to my father or mother, could you please come out and look at that? So I went out and looked, and I said, man, they crushed my work. And they said, somebody said that it might have been your son that did this. And my mom said, no, he's been with me. I mean, she just bald-faced lie. I mean, she didn't even ask me, did you do that? She didn't question. She just said, no, he's been with me. And throughout my youth, I noticed that my mom was lying for me a lot. Firemen would come to my door and say, where was your son in the last hour? Oh, he was with me. Okay. But, I nearly burned down LaGuardia Airport, man.
Oh, gosh.
I don't know. Some airport, Idlewild, whatever. Think it was maybe Idlewild. It was on the island. I set a lot on. I set a billboard on fire.
wasn't in the book.
A wooden billboard on fire, and this is when I was about six or seven, and the billboard caught on fire. I just wanted a little grass. I started a fire in the grass behind the billboard, so it would hide the fire. But the wind blew the fire into the billboard. The wind got, and the billboard was wooden, and it, oh, this huge blaze, and we try to stamp it out, but that's, you know, 6-year-old, 7-year-old kids trying to stamp out a big blaze. So we just ran. I said, okay, everybody, just let's get out of here, man. So I don't think I had man down yet. But,
yeah,
but
that came later.
We ran away. I ran home. I just went into my bedroom and just stayed there. And then sure enough, knock on the door, and there was this fireman all dressed in, you know, his fireman costume, smelling of smoke. And the fire was only like 3 or 4 blocks away on this main highway. And they said, you know, where was your son? There's been a big fire down there. There's a bunch of kids. And they say your son was with them. No, he was with me a whole time. And they say, oh, man. And she said, you've got to stop doing this stuff, Larry. You can't do this stuff. I mean, she didn't hit me. She didn't hit me. I was afraid my father would. She said, I'm not going to tell your father about this, because that was the, you mentioned my father. That he was just, he had a terrible temper, man.
Right.
He passive aggressive, but when he let it out, he exploded. It just didn't come. It just bam.
Bah! Wow.
He nearly, I think I mentioned it in the book. Maybe I didn't. He nearly beat my sister to death.
You did mention that he hit your sister. Yeah.
So did it help me in show business? I don't know, because maybe it pushed me into being a performer. It was the only way I could get any energy out.
Sure.
But on the other hand, he didn't give me any tools to do anything with that.
Right.
I had no tools. Once I got into show business, I had to learn how to, you know, live on my own, or I didn't have any tools. I didn't know how to learn. That I discovered. That's a real thing. I discovered in my 30s or 40s. I said, you know, I don't know how to learn.
Huh.
I just would have to, I learned that by being in show business and having to memorize lines. Or I joined Second City and the committee. I was a good improviser, but I learned through their groups, through those groups.
Sure.
I said, people are picking up stuff different than I do. I would just join and flail around until I just picked it up, you know, what everybody was doing. I would just learn by mistakes or you know, that kind of thing.
Sure.
Learn by experience.
Experience. Okay.
That's a nice way of saying I didn't know how to learn. So that's when I started to realize that I had dyslexia, that I got to learn how to learn, how to memorize. I didn't know how to be an actor, you know, what the rules of acting were.
Mm-hmm.
I had to learn that, you know, and then people would get mad. They'd say, hey, man, do this or do that or, you know, wake up or come on, man, get with it. And I go, okay. And until that started to fade away, because then I picked it up.
Yeah, it's like a certain protocol that you just don't know until you know. And yeah.
Yeah. But there's a way of, like, for instance, I never learned or never even heard of or used or knew about research. Research. A backstory. You know, sure. That's where it comes in show business. But right. Just research and doing a book and doing and researching anything that I was writing. If I was writing a screenplay, research? Nah. It's all in your head.
Yeah.
You, know, you got it in your head. You can just write anything. No, you can't. You know, and if you do research, you get better. It makes everything realer.
Right.
I mean, you know, but until I learned research, oh, you're doing research. I was lazy. That's what I picked up from home. Well, somebody will do something for you. You know, your mom, your dad.
Sure. Well, one thing that you and I have in common, a couple of things, you know, first of all, I'm a New Yorker as well. So I'm from the Bronx. Although I never met my father, but because of that, I think I had a lot of anger around that and everything. And I think that it affected me, but we have an improv background, you and I. So like you, I was at Second City, although I did Second City in Los Angeles, and then I was in their Las Vegas theater as well. And I want to talk a little bit about your improv, but I remember one time I had an improv teacher who told me, because you said lazy, I remember I had an improv teacher once who told me how improv is a lazy man's art form because it doesn't require research or memorization. You know, you just get out there on the stage in your t-shirt and do your thing.
Wow. No, he nailed it. That's exactly right. You don't have to I could screw around all day, man, and then I just get up on the stage and be a star.
That's it. You know, you can get away with half-ass accents and not really
going with references. Here's an interesting thing, man, that, about the accent thing. When I did Barry,
which was
the
story.
Last thing I did.
Yeah.
Last official thing. They called me and they said, we wanted you to do just a small part, but it's really great. And it's a Russian hitman. He's going to kill Barry's partner. So I said, I'd love to do it. I really like Bill Hader. I love the program. The program hadn't come on yet. Mm-hmm. They were doing the first three, and I was in the third. And they were just, banking it, and then they'll put him on.
Sure.
So I was in the third, so I couldn't look at it. Okay, but I liked the part. A hitman. And then they said, do you have a Russian accent? And I said, oh, yeah. Could you say yeah to everything? Can you ride a horse? Can you go over the waterfall? Sure. So then they said, you can. Well, that's really good. Then would you mind if we had a Russian speech actor or whatever you call it, line person, a speech person. A dialogue coach. Would you mind if we had a Russian dialogue coach just to make sure? And I said, that's great. No, I'd love it. Thank you very much. Wonderful. So because all I had in my mind, I didn't say it, but I knew all I had was my Second City committee Russian accent. It's just. So I thought, okay. But as long as they have a dialogue coach, I'm fine. So I showed up and it was just a one day shoot. And it was in the afternoon, so I didn't go in the morning. I came in during lunch. Okay. So they said, I said, when am I going to shoot my scene? And they said, it's going to be in about 2 hours. You should get in your costume and get ready. They gave me they had sent me the words. Mm-hmm. So I had the words. I said, where's the dialogue coach? I'd like to talk to the dialogue coach, because I knew Second City is not going to cut it here. This is the majors. So they said, I don't know. We don't know. So I'm walking around now. I'm there 2 hours, man. I only got another hour. I only got another half hour. I'm looking around. Does anybody know where the dialogue coach is? No, I don't know. Oh, my God. And then that AD comes and says, you're up. Let's go. And I go, oh, my God, I might have to use my Second City dialogue. Oh, my God. Okay, so I started, blah, 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 and I'm using this Second City Russian accent. And Bill Hader, who's directing, and he also wrote, but he's directing with his writer, co-writer, the co-director. Now, there's the two people who carry me in, who lead me in, don't carry me in, they lead me in. They're my friends, my Russian friends lead me in. And there's the guy I'm going to hit, guy I'm going to kill. So that's three people. I'm the fourth. Okay, and he's directing. And he's directing everybody but me. He's not talking to me at all. Do this, do that. Okay, let's do it. Take one, take two. Directing. Nothing. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, I got this. I can't find a dialogue coach. He probably knows I'm doing a committee accent. He doesn't want to talk to me. I'm fucking up. I'm going to be fired. He's not talking to me. I don't know what's going on. Blah, blah, blah. We're shooting the whole afternoon. And now he's on, and you do roundy. Mm-hmm. What you do, a little bit of all you. And the star, the lead of the scene, the one who's pushing the scene, You do him last. So he can rehearse all the time until you get around. So boom, boom, and then they finally get to me, and he's really doing a lot of work on me, but he's not talking to me. He said, okay, let's do it again. And I'm thinking it's my accent.
Right.
And he's changing the camera. Finally, it's over. So this is all tense to me. I mean, this is not fun at all. I thought it was going to be fun, but he's not talking to me and the accent thing, and I can't find the dialogue coach. It's all too much. He said, thank you very much. Doesn't say anything to me. Okay. I leave. I change into my street clothes. Now I'm going to go home. I pass through the set. I go over and I say, I gotta find out what's going on. So I go over to Bill and I say, can I talk to you for a second? He goes, sure. You know, he's always happy, very nice.
Right.
I said, why didn't you direct me? You were talking to everybody, man. You were telling them to do this. You were doing that. And nothing. You never talked to me. Why is that? And I'm expecting him to say, well, I was going to fire you, but let's get on with this. And he said, well, you see, me and my partner, and his partner is standing there. He says, me and my partner, when we wrote this part, we didn't write it the way you were doing it. And we didn't know what the hell you were doing, but you were doing something great. And since we didn't know what you were doing or where you were coming from, we said, hands off, leave them alone and let them go.
Wow.
And I said, are you serious? And he goes, yeah, why? And I go, oh, I just wondered why you weren't directing me. And then his partner said, come here, I want to show you something. And I said, you're not going to show me what I did, are you? And he said, well, come on. And he shows me, and he shows me the scene, you know, that they take. And I go, wow, that's really good. And there was this woman watching with us, the three of us were watching.
Right.
And I'm going, wow, that's really good. I didn't, and I said to her, what do you think? And she said, yeah, that's really fine. I said, have you seen, you work here? And she said, yeah. I said, have you seen the dialogue coach? And she said, I'm the dialogue coach. And I said, how was the accent? And she said, it was fine.
She was probably from Second City too.
No, she was a real, honest to God, Russian dialogue coach. And she said, no, I have nothing to say. You were fine.
You had a killer accent, even know it, man.
Well, I guess, but that's how I went through show business. It was always, I didn't know what was going on, really. That was all. You know, it didn't have to be bad or good. Just tell me what's going on.
I love it. One thing that you talked about, man, when you were talking about your improv, that you have to have done improv to understand this. I almost got chills when you were writing about it, which was when you were talking about the committee, talking about editing the scene. It was when Carl Gottlieb was now in, like, doing the lights.
Right.
I found I never had a light. I never had to operate a light, but I had to edit scenes from within, like swiping a scene or whatever. That is the hardest fucking thing to do in improv. Because if you do it too soon, yes, you're killing a good scene.
Right.
If you let it go too long, you're leaving them out there to hang.
Yes. Yeah, you're the only one so far has picked up on that. But ooh, when I wrote that, and then I dug it like you dug it. I said, well, man, this guy knows about improv. Me. When I read it, I said, oh, wow, I know what I'm talking about. And all the other stuff about improv, well, because I directed a show and the director, our director, Alan Meyerson, mm-hmm, he was going to leave to go down and direct down there for a week or so. He said, Larry, you know, you direct a show. I said, well, what do I have to know? And he told me, he said, you know, you can't. Here's the secret of directing improv. When you watch it, you're the director. You're watching the thing. You're watching them improv. You watch it for a couple of minutes, and you know exactly where it should go. You can't tell them that. You can't say anything. Leave them alone. If you say something, they'll depend on you, and they'll stop improvising.
Right.
They'll just improvise until it dies, and then they'll come to you and say, well, what should we do? So you got to shut your mouth, bite your tongue. And here's the other thing. that goes with that. If you leave them alone long enough and just say, let's do it again tomorrow night, it may take a week, it may take 6 months, but they'll eventually get to what you saw in the first 3 days.
Interesting.
They'll get there because there's only so many ways where they began can go. And maybe 100 ways, and maybe 5 ways.
Right.
But they'll get there, however many ways.
So then
you just shut up.
Was the committee then like Second City in that the purpose was to create sketch comedy through improv? Like improvising until it developed into a sketch or
yes.
No? Okay.
Yes.
I always found that frustrating. When I was at Second City, I always had a writer's brain. Like I'd come in, I had a clear idea how I wanted to do it. But then you'd have to, they force you to kind of discover through improv. So now you're at the mercy of some other person's thoughts. And I don't know, I guess I was selfish. Like my idea, I had a clear vision for it. And now I was at the mercy of my scene partner. And that just drove me crazy. I think Del Close too. That's why he eventually left Second City, I think, you know.
How long were you in Second City before you quit?
I did improv for probably 4 or 5 years. Not as long as you.
Oh no, wait a minute. So now, wait a minute. That's weird. Because if, from what you were telling me as a director, you wouldn't last 2 seconds.
Oh, yeah. Probably.
So, but you must have been good enough to last 4 or 5 years.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I played along. I certainly played along. I just found I loved improv. But what I found frustrating is when we would go to create a sketch show that you couldn't come in with written material. It had to be, okay, here's my idea and let's discover it. In my brain, I was like, look, if Larry has an idea, I'll work with him all day long and improvise. That's great. But my idea, I kind of have it fleshed out. Here's how I want it to go. You know, and I know.
No, that's not improv.
I know that. I always saw them as two separate things, improv and sketch. I liked to write sketch, but I wanted to do improv.
We were totally political and social improv.
Love it. Okay.
And it was fun. I mean, I was great at it.
Yeah.
That's probably the best I'll ever be.
Yeah.
Was in the committee, not even in Second City, but the committee, because I was there for 10 years. I didn't want to leave.
Gotcha.
But I hated being a director. I felt there were 5 people between me and the audience as a director. Because I would see where this scene would go, just like you said. You can see it if you stand back from it. You can see.
Oh, sure.
But because if you're writing sketches, you can kind of see what the scene
right.
is.
Yeah, I loved it. Speaking of the committee, I got to spend in about 2005, I think it was, I spent some time with Paul Wilson.
He's great.
He's a nice guy. I was in something called the International Sketch Comedy Competition or something. I was in a sketch group and we were in this competition and Paul Wilson was like the celebrity judge. And that was pretty exciting. I actually got to meet him in the men's room. We talked.
Was that at the improv?
No, this was in downtown LA somewhere. It was some theater, I don't think I ever went to downtown LA except that one time.
Yeah.
But it was like some old bank that they converted into a really nice theater, like a big theater. Oh, okay. And they had this, what they call the International Sketch Comedy Competition. And my team actually placed second. We did well. But I remember Paul was one of the judges. So when I read his name in your book, I didn't realize he came out of the committee. I just always knew him from Cheers.
No, he didn't. He came out of the Pitchell Players.
That's right. But you guys kind of hung out together, right?
Well, because he was like, I'd say 5 long blocks away from the committee theater. So we would just switch. Sure. He would come in and just do our, you know, we did 3 shows, 2 shows and a complete improv show.
Okay.
So he would come in after his show and do the improv show with us. Or I would, on my day, night off, go improv with them.
Love it. And that's where Edie came out of there, right? Didn't she?
And Edie McClurg, yeah. Bob McClurg, and another woman who, Robin Mankin. Those 4 people were great.
Mm-hmm.
Edie McClurg was incredible and Robin Mankin was incredible. And Paul Wilson, incredible. I would just go watch them.
That's awesome, man. And yeah. So when you're there, it just sounds like, so you're in San Francisco. It sounds like at that period of time, the committee's huge. But then everyone starts going to LA. Like you were like the last holdout, it seemed like. Were they just giving away sitcoms or what was that like back then? It seemed like everyone was becoming famous.
It was a weird anomaly in that if we took off a week, you know, or a couple of days to go down and audition and look for representation so we could become famous movie stars down there, if we took off, we would have a very hard time getting auditions. I mean, you know, you're like any actor, you know, you have to call and make appointments or we don't have time. It's just very hard to audition and get a representation.
Sure.
But they would fly up because we were in a hit show. So the casting people and the directors would fly up to see what the heck is going on up there. They're you know, packing the house every night, which we were. So they would fly up and they would see us and hire us. I mean, you can't get a better audition than your own show.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And Second City was just far enough away, whereas San Francisco is the easier trip. Yeah.
Yeah, this was a cheaper trip for the same talent, kind of. But the curse was that they took us too early. Mm. Now, everybody was leaving and we didn't get our chops down good enough up there. So we became half-assed. So none of us became real stars down there. We just became character actors. Hmm. Whereas Second City left you alone. Hollywood
Understood.
Didn't go there.
Right.
So you could be there for a year or two before you were discovered. And you had enough chops and tools to make it in Hollywood. But none of us had enough tools to make it. We didn't have that fire in the belly. Chicago gave you a fire in the belly. It was far away. Hollywood is far away. We got to be great. But now it's down there. We can go anytime. You know, so we didn't.
Gotcha. I catch you long enough. I know you're so kind. I had two quick questions for you. And maybe they're quick. We'll see. But looking back, Larry, would you change anything?
Everything.
Everything.
I don't know. I mean, I had a great life. I think about that, too. When I write this book, I'm thinking, well, this will probably be my last thing. Then I'll either go back on the stage. But, you know, I don't know anything else I would do. My attitude, I would change my attitude. I wouldn't change anything about what I did. I love the arc of my life. But my attitude, I had a chip on my shoulder that was just, and that was comes from my family. I mean, I didn't know how to change my mind. I didn't know how to do research. I didn't know what was better. You know, I thought where I was always great.
Got you.
And if I got great at where I was, then I would go to the next level. But you got to be great where you are and do research about what the next level is because it's different than where you are. And I just thought it would be the same, but it's not. And I never, like when I was there doing a stand-up comedy act, I met all the great comedians.
Right.
But I would just meet them. I wouldn't think like them. What they were thinking was, I want to have a show of my own, or I want to do arena shows eventually from the coffee house.
Right.
Or I want to do nightclubs. And I never thought that way. I thought, I'm here forever. I wanted to be a stand-up comedian forever. I wanted to be in Second City forever. I wanted to be in the committee forever. I wanted to be auditioning in the beginning.
Right.
Forever. I never thought beyond what I was doing. So that kind of, you have to think, you know, be here, think ahead.
Sure.
Be here, think ahead.
That reminds me of a quote of yours. I wrote it down. There's no such thing as selling out. I gave up because I had no solid dream.
Wow, that's brilliant.
That was you, man.
I realized that. I don't know, you know, I mean, because you said that. I mean, that's been told to me. Mm-hmm. So I just repeated it. But,
Fair enough.
You know, I didn't make that up on my own. But that's true. You know, Don Quixote said that a long time ago. The impossible dream.
Hmm.
That's what he was talking about, man. And he's my main man.
Don Quixote?
Cervantes, Don Quixote.
Gotcha.
Because he was the great pretender. He was me. you know, and my, he thought he was more than he was. And through that, he became other than he was, which was better by far. He was pure. He just wasn't who he thought he was.
Well, on that note, I'll wrap this up, Larry. I appreciate you doing this. Let's talk about the book. Where can we purchase the book?
It's Amazon.com is the best place to get it. You can get it in any bookstore, I hope, I think. I don't know. So that. But you didn't ask me about my life. Yeah, we talked about show business. See, you fell for the trap.
Maybe the next time we'll get there, man. I don't want to keep it too long. But I believe me, I could.
How long have we been doing this?
We've been on for about an hour now.
Okay, cool.
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, maybe down the road. You know,
I would love to, Larry. Actually, I'm gonna reach out to you. I'll email you. I'd love to get you back on, because you know one thing I'd like to do is actually maybe talk about some of the credits. Which, by the way, I'd be remiss if I didn't say I've seen a lot of your projects. Obviously, grew up watching you. You're part of everyone's Christmas now between Planes, Trains, and Automobiles and Home Alone.
Right.
But my favorite has always been Charlie Butts.
Name, kid?
Charlie Butts.
Charlie's butt?
Butts. Charlie Butts.
You got a funny friggin' name, kid.
Yeah. What's your name?
Al Capone.
I thought you was dead.
Me dead? I got too much money. I'll never die.
Charlie Butts is my favorite. That's the best. That's the best I ever did. You know why? I'll tell you why. If you got a second. It's that that's me. That is Larry Hankin. See, I didn't know how to act. And Don Siegel, who cast me, he didn't audition me. He talked to me. He called me in and talked to me. And he saw I didn't know my ass from my elbow. He didn't know. He knew that I didn't know how to act. And that's what he wanted. Because all through the movie, he kept on telling me, get in here. Get in this scene. Well, what am I doing? I don't care. Just get in there.
Right.
When Clint cut his fingers off. Mm. You know, the guy cut.
Clint
cut his fingers off. I'm not in that scene. I wasn't written in that scene. He said, get in there. I go, what am I doing? He said, the guy's cutting his fingers off. Just get in there. Don't worry about it. You know, just get in there. I need people in there. He always said, I need another body in there. So I got in there and then, you know, I said, well, this is, you know, and then when it came time for the guy to cut his fingers off, he goes, boom. And then he goes around and he gets a reaction shot from everybody who was in the shop. You know, bump, bump. So he goes, okay. You know, hey, Larry, give me a reaction. And I go, oh, my God. And he goes, no, throw up, vomit. And I go, so, I mean, and that's my part through the whole movie. And then when I finally the movie came out, they gave me co-star credit.
That's amazing. Yeah.
It is, because I didn't audition for that. They didn't tell me that.
What a nice surprise when you saw that pop up on the screen, huh?
Oh, it blew my mind. I mean, he just said, hey, well, you're having a – the cast and crew screening.
Right.
So I went, you know, wow, co-star. I didn't know. But that's how they treated me. And that's why it's your favorite or mm-hmm. my favorite. It's because it's real. I was just reacting. I wasn't acting. And that's the key to acting, is just react. Right. And have your lines down. That's the other thing.
I love it.
Yeah.
Well, Larry, I promise I will hit you up and beg you to do this again. I've enjoyed so much talking to you. I enjoyed your book, That Guy, A Cautionary Memoir. Larry Hankin,
well, thank you. But it's great that you were in improv, too. So you kind of got what I was talking about.
Oh, absolutely, man. I did. And we'll do this again. I'd love to have you back on.
Cool, man.
Okay, all right, Larry, have a great rest of your day, man. We'll talk soon.
Bye.
Bye.
Oh, man, that was fun. That was special. What a great guest. What a mensch, Larry Hankin. So check out the book. I bought it on Amazon. I know it's also available in bookstores. It's called That Guy, A Cautionary Memoir. Hit me up on Facebook. I am Real Fanicek. I'm always looking for more friends because I'm needy that way. Hit me up on Twitter at Fanicek Podcast, or you can email me, fanicekpodcast@gmail.com. Of course, I got the YouTube channel. Hit the link. You can watch my interview with Larry Hankin. Watch the magic that the two of us have. He and I were soulmates, basically. But what I really need you to do, listen up. Stay tuned for the next exciting episode of Fanicek.